Well, welcome again, and nice to see so many people in the session and still here at the conference, which is always a good sign. This round table or workshop is very much for you to talk and contribute and share ideas. So I'm here purely as a facilitator. And I thought the approach we would take, if everybody was happy, was to work through the bullets that actually were put down on the agenda, because I think it's quite nicely structured in terms of what these sport event discussions should be about and could be about. I do recognise quite a lot of faces in the room, so I know there's a lot of experience here in terms of people who've directly been involved in major events and bids and sponsorship and broadcast and promotion and so on. So hopefully it'll be a good and lively session. A host city are recording this, so it will be a round table of record. There are a couple of journalists in the room, but they're okay. You know, just be, if you're going to be outrageous, say it's off the record, and then they can't quote you. I think we should just get going, really, because obviously we've had a lot of different themes around the conference over the last couple of days. But I wonder if we could just start with this question of, and a genuine question about the benefits of hosting sporting events. As it's put here, what are the human, commercial and marketing benefits, but also perhaps what might be the disbenefits or the challenges? Because, you know, frankly, the research, when you look at it across major events in the modern era, is quite mixed. As to what are the true nature of benefits. And there are quite a lot of academics who say, when you look at it as a cost-benefit analysis, particularly in terms of the mega events, there's more cost than benefit. So I think we can have perhaps an open and honest discussion here, and perhaps, you know, colleagues here talking a bit about their own experience. So I suppose that the question is, you know, these major sporting events, are they worth it? Are you able to bid for them? What's been your experience of hosting? So there are microphones, if you just indicate who you are and where you're from, and then we can get going. So we'll start here. Yeah, thanks.
Eric Anderson from AROOPS. I'd like to sort of cast a vision more than anything else. We, in our company, we just finished a job with a local consultant for a city that is looking at bidding for the 2028 Olympics. And the whole scope of that exercise was around how can a possible bid for the Olympic Games strengthen the development plans of the region, the city, and even the country. So they want to start very early at looking at what you know, necessary feasibility studies and cost-benefit studies can help to strengthen the case for this or that aspect of the regional city and country plans. And then as an outcome of that, they will then decide whether it's worth it actually to bid for the Olympic Games.
I mean, it raises an interesting point, which is, if there's a strategy to bid for the games linked to, let's say, developing infrastructure, venues, raising international profile, what other event strategies are also in play? Because it may be the games is a prize too far, but are there other events, this idea, I would say, of appropriate bidding? Are there other colleagues want to comment on that or take that up a bit? You were nodding your head, so I wonder whether you wanted to say something. This colleague here, yeah.
Thanks. Andy Priest from ACOM. I just remembered actually that, is anybody here from the Netherlands?
The Netherlands, love the Dutch, you know that.
Yeah, they're looking worried now. The Netherlands had a 2028 Olympic plan, correct? And that was, I think, one of the most far-reaching attempts, if you like, to almost do a reverse legacy approach. And I don't think, I think a lot of, I mentioned this earlier, a lot of event bidding is a bit reactive. There isn't enough kind of forward thinking. And the further forward you think, the greater potential there is to realise the benefits that cities are after. The downside is two downsides. One is the political dimension. I think in the Netherlands, the plan eventually fell foul of the politicians. But also the challenge to the host city or country of sustaining the interest in the bid for that amount of time. It's just not possible, you know, it will probably go up and down, but it's just not possible to sustain it. So you know, pros and cons of trying to plan ahead that far, basically.
Yeah, I think the other element to that is that when you look at the mega events like the Olympic and Paralympic Games, I mean, there's an element of continental rotation. So the problem about planning, and I was involved in some of those conversations, actually feels like already 6-7 years ago about a Dutch bid for 28, is that if a European city, potentially Paris, was to win in 2024, a European bid in 28 is dead in the water anyway. So, you know, this thing about understanding the cycle you're in and the geographical market continental ambitions of the rights holders is also an important factor to consider. John, yeah.
When you consider the original question about, you know, what are the benefits for a city to host these big events, I still think there's a bit of a mismatch between what the quite traditional rights holders, the IOC and beyond. And I know there's Agenda 2020 and others, and there's discussions going on, but I still see a very traditional set of rights holders, and then a new world of cities and governments and people that want value for money, etc. And I think there is a mismatch between the two, and I think it would be much easier to make the case for a lot of these big events in terms of the return if actually the rights holders changed the agenda and said, actually, we're going to make this so much more sustainable. And we heard one or two people talk about sustainability this morning. We also heard about things like security, the vast cost this morning. And it would just be so refreshing to try and stop the ever escalating cost of staging these mega events and actually say, you know, this is almost, this is the model. It's capped at this level of cost. And suddenly it will be opened up to so many more cities. The cost benefit analysis would be so much easier to justify. And actually, you could have a global bidding scenario again, rather than actually perhaps some of the mega events being only available for fewer and fewer really big cities. And I think almost the rights holders have to catch up with where the world is now and where most cities want it to go, and perhaps stop the race for ever escalating costs.
That's a good point. Any thoughts on that? I mean, one thing to throw in the mix there, though, if you do have new markets and developing countries who might have, say, petrochemical oil resources available, and they're coming into a marketplace and offering to host your championships, sometimes it's difficult to say no, of course. Yes?
Just to basically a comment. I come to the conclusion, my background is the Olympics. I worked on 10 Olympics for the last 25 years. I come to the conclusion that you actually don't need one single agenda for the Olympics. You need three different agendas as a framework of thought. You need to have the first agenda, which is obviously to do the games the best you can for reputational reasons and all of that. You need to have the second agenda, which is to provide some kind of sporting legacy, so you satisfy the people who want more venues and more participation in sports and so on. But the third agenda is becoming the most important one, and that is what you use the Olympics for. For London 2012, it was the regeneration of Stratford. It would never happen. It cost 1.8 billion to make it into a building site or whatever it was. But it would never happen without the Olympics giving the City of London, pardon my expression, a kick in the back. It would never have happened. And you see some of the most successful Olympics in over the last 20 years are those who have had a strong third agenda. In other words, something you can sell to the population of the city or the region And you can tell them this is what's in it for you. It's not just 16 days of fun and games. This is what's in it for you. And if you can clarify that in your mind and sell that to the population of the city, you solve the problem of referendums and everything.
Yeah, and it's a good point. I'm just thinking as well about let's go down the scale a little bit, though, in terms of world and European championships and non-Olympic sports, where obviously the questions are slightly different. So, yeah, over here.
Thanks. It's Miles Pierce. I'm the commercial director for World Snooker, as well as working with the Matchroom Group. We have about 700 days per year of events that are happening all over the world. And I think the key that we want to say is basically, I know there's been a lot of talk about the Olympics. There's been a lot of talk about mega events. But there's really, if you're looking at ROI, if you're looking at commercial benefits, marketing benefits, even television and broadcast around, you know, a multitude of countries. So we as World Snooker, are broadcast in 89 countries around the world. It's easier to look at the smaller events or the medium-sized events with less investment needed in order to do that, using facilities which are probably already available in the host city. And, you know, just if you're doing it that way and you're looking for real kind of ROI, then I think, you know, let's talk about, you know, some of the smaller events. Let's have a think about that. It's not always the Olympics, and most people can't afford the Olympics, as we know.
I think it's a good point. I'm just also wondering, are there any colleagues in the room, perhaps from a city or event organisers, who've actually created events outside of the traditional federation structure? Because as John said earlier, there's a whole new dynamic now built around things like the X Games and Red Bull initiatives that are actually sitting almost outside of the official structures. Anybody worked in that environment would want to comment? Ah, you were just the microphone guy. I thought you were going to take my pointer. Never mind. Maybe we'll move on then. So the second point is guidelines for successful major event bidding. What can cities or nations do to have maximum success? So I wonder if there's colleagues in the room who've been involved in a successful bid for any sort of event, as Miles said, it doesn't have to be mega, where they feel they've developed a particular narrative or thinking or approach that worked. Yes, over here, yeah.
Marianne Meyer from TDH, Theatrism. In my previous job, I was in charge of the federal police for the Euro 2008 for the bid that was successful with Switzerland and Austria. And the approach there was that, like with UFF, we had many, many meetings, and the main thing was like, you bring the house and we bring the party. That was the approach they had. And I think this was part of the difficulty, and I think this is a shift in reasoning that is already happening, but that needs to go forward in the point that it's like the respect and the involvement of the local population and also of the local reality, and that it's the other way around, or that is okay, if you bring the party to a house, you leave the house in a decent way, or you help to clean up at the end, and kind of this of a more respectful way. And to take it further is not only not to do harm to the house, but it's maybe to give an opportunity for the house then to look nicer even afterwards. I think there is a substantial shift in that, and that the traditional set of right holders, as they were called before, really need to move on in this direction, that they have a responsibility how they leave the house behind.
Yeah, and I think just to add, I mean, one of the dilemmas of a major event bidding is, on the one hand, you have to have a focus on the domestic and local market and communities and make sure you've got ideas and plans that fit with the development of a city, are going to be popular, could potentially withstand a referendum, but actually the decisions are not taken locally or domestically, they're taken internationally. So how do you combine that, let's call it local stakeholder approach, with actually pitching to an international audience that have a limited interest in your city? I wonder if there's any reflections on that. A Come back on another one later, I think. You've had a good shout. Go on then, quick one.
I think the key to a good bid is to get the balance right between the different stakeholder groups and not to cater to any specific stakeholder to the detriment of any others. I think that's the key to a good bid. If you allow one stakeholder group to sort of write the agenda, then the others will not basically accept it. So I think that's the key thing.
Yeah, I mean, I've done a few myself, and won a few, and I think the key actually is there's many different keys, but one of the keys is it's a word that we use a lot in our work, which is developing a powerful narrative, and a narrative that works domestically, it works in terms of your local communities, and it works in terms of the international decision makers. And it may well be that the parts of the narrative you're turning up the volume on internationally may be different to what you're doing domestically, but to have a story that's coherent and can withstand a lot of scrutiny. Because I think the other thing that's changed, is the quality of the assessment, the quality of the forensics that go on in terms of a bid, the guarantees that are required, and ultimately also having maybe something of an emotional appeal. I mean, your point about the house being in better order, it's also that the tournament or the event that's coming needs to leave in better order. That ultimately the rights holder needs to feel they're coming and they're going to leave with their event having been boosted, having got a new flavor, having got a new audience. So it's that local, national, international relationship that you've got to think about, frankly, whether you're bidding to host a snooker event or bidding to host a world championship. So okay, that's good. What about influencing, it says your national sport body, but I think generally in terms of influencing decision makers, and that includes the final decision makers that may be the rights holder or the relevant sponsor or possible broadcasters. John, I wonder if you'd say, just to get this one going, to talk a little bit about your experience in the European Sports Championships, because there you've been working a lot with federations and with broadcasters, and ultimately then having to turn to cities and actually creating something both building on a foundation but new in the marketplace. Just tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, so in terms of the European Sports Championships, it was a pretty complex environment, as Paul Bristow was talking about this morning, and we had to get lots of stars to align in terms of host cities and broadcasts and things like that. But we very much started with the governing bodies, and we spoke to many, many sports to see who was potentially interested in bringing their current European Championships together. And it took, it's taken 5 years of conversations, and I guess we shouldn't be surprised by that, because the European federations, they are bodies that are quite conservative, and I understand why. They need to protect their sports and their European Championships, which go back over 100 years in some cases. So there's a lot of heritage there, and there's a big responsibility those European federations have to make sure they nurture it and make sure they have another 100 years ahead. But as a result, that there has been a lot of caution, even though everyone gets the power of aggregation and the whole is greater than the sum of the parts, and all those elements, and they get the fact that by bringing together their sports, suddenly they're able to play in a completely different broadcast landscape. For example, rather than being on thematic channels, they're suddenly able to be on EBU free-to-air channels, including, for example, the BBC here. But so they got all the benefits, but they also, they are organisations that need to look after the integrity of their sport, and that control element was really important. So where we got to make sure that this worked for every party, because it's this concept is very much creating balance between all parties, is that yes, everyone is bringing their European Championships to a new multi-sport event that is going to be organised over 12 days, but at the same time, each of the European federations keeps absolute control of their own at their own competition. So, you know, the athletics, the aquatics, the cycling, the gymnastics, the triathlon, the rowing, etc., will be delivered in exactly the way that the European Federation wants them to be. And we are, and Glasgow and Berlin are not getting kind of involved in interfering with the integrity of their sport. And that's the balancing act that that we've created to make sure that it works for both a new concept and the broadcasters and the host cities, but also for the federations as well. They're in absolute control of their own sports. And also, the organisation is run and governed by a board, European Sports Championships 2018 board, where every stakeholder sits on that board. So the seven sports, the two host cities in the European Broadcast Union, all sit at that table. And for the really important decisions, unanimous decisions are required. So everyone has to be very much aligned, has to go with decisions. And there's an awful lot of debate, you can imagine, before some of those key decisions are made. And looking to the future in terms of what sports are added, you know, which host cities are entertained, all those decisions will be made at that board level. So it's been a real challenge because we haven't been able to rely on anything that's been done before. We've had to make it up as we go along, and we've still got some big decisions to make. But at least we now have the structure, we have the governance model in place that was actually only signed off 3 weeks ago at a board meeting in Paris, and I think we have the building blocks now to go forward and build. But it's about getting this balancing act between all the parties and making sure that people enjoy the benefits of collective aggregation, but also very much keep control of their own individual sports. So hopefully that kicks it off.
Thanks. It reminds me actually of you know, the importance of and the art of good listening. You know, I often see people putting bids together and thinking about events they want to go for, and they've not listened to what the Federation has been saying, they've not listened to the broadcasters, they've not thought about it in terms of sponsors, because it's so easy to get caught up, you know, within the, let's say, the local woods and trees, that sometimes you don't see the bigger picture. So, you know, I think one of the lessons that's come out of my own experience, but you know, talking a lot to many colleagues in the sport event world, and this also contributions made here, you know, understanding the landscape you're in and the different needs and demands and aspirations of the sport itself, of the federation, of their stakeholders, and tailoring your thinking to that seems to me to be, you know, very important art. And I've seen, you know, what looked, I mean, if you want to take a mega event, say the Olympic Games, I've seen a bid like Madrid, 2012, 2016, 2020. They weren't listening. They weren't learning. It was the same bid every time, and they lost every time. So, you know, I think this question of appreciating, particularly what a rights holder may want out of it, that's a very important part of the process of getting the right sort of bid together. Any other reflections on that, or people's own experience?
Can I just, last thing from me,
yeah,
I promise not to keep the microphone too long. Can I just say that listening thing is a really important element. My background is the commercial element of sport. So in my career, I've generally sat down with people as sort of culturally pretty like-minded, and you try and get a deal done, and you get a deal done or you don't. Through working on the European Sports Championships, because it's governing bodies, it's commercial, it's cities, it's broadcasters, certainly we've learned that we've had to have, you know, a much wider range of approaches, and as you say, really listen to what people want to get things across the line, and you can't just rely on one approach, and it's one of the big learnings that certainly I've come across over the last 3 or 4 years.
Good. I mean, it's a sort of sense everybody, you know, has an aspiration. A city has an aspiration. A rights holder has an aspiration and ambition. It's where you can get those coming together in the right way. Do you start, you know, developing the success of an event? So, which links quite nicely to the next point about rights holders and organising committees and ensuring good press and communications. I mean, one of the predictions you can make is if you're hosting a mega event, you're guaranteed very bad press and communications, and almost all of the build-up. It's late, it's over budget, it should go in the health service. You know, I can go through them, we can rehearse them. Rio are going through those agonies with the addition of polluted waters in the mix. So it doesn't guarantee you anything hosting a major event, but obviously it does give you an international platform. It can maximise media interest. If you get the right strategy, it can have huge benefits. to your city and to the rights holder. So I wonder if anybody's got any particular experience, good or bad, on that front they wanted to share with us. Yes, over here.
Guido Bau, Infostrada Sports. We don't really have experience, of course, in communications, you know, prior to the event. But I know that having worked with press operations games time at single sport, smaller single sport or multi-sports events to the bigger ones like the Olympics, press really wants to do what they are there to do. That means that any distraction to any other discussions would just lead them from their primary task is write about the event, write about the athletes, write about the sports and how that engages with their audiences. So we've come to learn that, you know, access to the event, you know, access to means of communication to get the word out really rapidly, whether they're off-site or on-site, access to information, TV commentators, media info systems, is really helping, you know, increase the exposure and positive exposure of the event, because then they can really use all that, all those means to do what they are there to do, is write about, you know, the sporting results, the events, the athletes, and the competitiveness, and not be distracted by, you know, lacking Wi-Fi or congested mixed zones and all that kinds of you know distractions that are always there. So, you know, we've seen that, you know, when press operations works really closely with the media to supply them with what they would really need, games, news services, those types of instruments as well, that these events traditionally or on generally enjoy a wider, more global exposure in a more positive way at and around the event.
I think it's a very good point. I mean, the quality of your media operations can have a huge impact on the quality of the coverage. And I'll give you two examples at different end of the spectrum. I mean, everybody I know, I wasn't there personally, but was at the Atlanta Games, tells me what a wonderful Games it was. You know, great experience, fantastic sport. But they got one thing wrong, which was essentially their media operations. The computers didn't work. The transport was a disaster. And now that game has almost been expunged from history because of the way the media wrote about it, because they were upset, best to keep them not upset. And the other example, the other end of the spectrum, I would say, would be London 2012, because, I mean, during the bid and afterwards, one of the things that we really focused on is the number of non-accredited media that comes to a mega event. And, of course, traditionally, and it's the point you're making, the accredited media, those who are covering the sport, covering the event, that's their focus, and that's good. But actually, in Olympic Games now, there's something close to 6,000 non-accredited media. So a commitment we gave in the bid, which was then delivered by the organizing committee, was to have a non-accredited media center. And every day, working in partnership with Visit London, Visit Britain, and the mayor's office, there was a program linked to those non-accredited media. They're all there to cover disaster stories, doping athletes, bombs, you know, whatever they could find, basically. But by moving it onto a level equivalent to the accredited media, so they actually had a quality service, they had a press office and a media operations center to work from, and they were given a regular flow of stories, and we encouraged other partners to be joining in creating those stories, and London didn't have any, you know, major disasters, then I think it was one of the reasons that the London Games got such brilliant media. It was actually both accredited and non-accredited, you know, had a proper media management program around them. Any other observations on that? Anybody want to talk about a communications disaster they've been involved in? I could, but I'm not going to. So, no. Only talk about the winners. So here we go. What can sports do, and maybe do more, to make themselves appealing to cities? So this may go into the areas of sports presentation, venue demands, venue locations, the way in which they're perhaps changing format of their sport in order to accommodate, like 3-on-3 basketball, for example. What can sports, both from a sports perspective and thinking about it from the city's perspective, what can they do to make themselves more interesting, attractive, beneficial to cities? just see if there's anybody else first, and then, yeah, here. Colleague here, yeah.
Hi, it's Jason Ferguson, president of World Snooker's governing body. I think the one thing they can do is listen to their customers. You know, you spoke earlier about listening, being a good listener. The one thing that's made our tour very successful over the last 5 years, it's gone from 6 events to 27 events in 5 years. What we've done, we've actually integrated each event with each city. So we've gone to the city before we've started the event. We've talked to them. What are the city needs? What is the industry in the city? Is it tourism you want? Is it relationships with other cities that you want? It's really understanding what that customer needs and then designing your sport to work with that in terms of your media.
Could you, and it's an interesting point, could you give us maybe a living example where that's been brought to bear and it's produced either a new event or enhanced an existing event?
Yeah, I mean, let me just go back. I probably could talk about our World Championships to start with. We'll soon be celebrating 40 years in Sheffield. And over that period of time, the events got stronger and stronger in the city. And the reason for that is we've integrated with the city further and further and understood what the city wants. They want kids off the street. They want to reduce their cost in policing. They want to see better education. And what we've done, we've used our sport to integrate with the schools' programmes, to bring in the media with that, so they're putting a good message out globally. And also, you know, as part of that, our ticket sales have gone up, you know, 50% in the last few years. Because there's more media going out, whether that be just at grassroots level or whether it be actually to do with the event. And that's one example, but the other side of that is that the massive benefit that the city gets in return. I mean, if you walk down the street in Beijing, which is our second largest market, is China, and you ask, you know, you say, give me three cities in England, they'll say London, Sheffield, and Manchester United probably. And that's what you get. But what that's brought, it's brought £5.1 million of income into the city in terms of people travelling into the city from that event. Now, we understood that from working with the city, that's what they wanted. And on top of that, you know, that over that same period, Chinese students to universities countrywide in England, there's a study done by Oxford University, 36% was the increase over 5 years of Chinese students coming to the city. In Sheffield, where our World Championship was, over the same period of time, 234% was the increase of Chinese students through making the city famous and working with the city. So, I mean, that's just one example.
Can I ask that also has been about reinvention, hasn't it? Because in a way, you've been in the crucible for all these years. So each year, you've had to sort of enhance the event, but while keeping it as the traditional showcase. So what's been the sort of tricks of that one?
Well, you know, the sport actually hasn't changed a bit. What actually goes on in the arena hasn't changed at all. What's changed is how our television works, how our media works, how we've expanded. So that's, you know, it is really, like you say, about reinventing. But it's more about reinventing the message that's going out there and putting those positive stories out. And on top of that, you know, that leads to other opportunities because other cities have then contacted us and said, actually, you know, we wouldn't mind doing an event. We've got a steel industry or an oil industry and we want to enhance our tourism and we've worked with incredible India and amazing Thailand and some of the tourist facilities there. So, you know, we have reinvented, but actually nothing's changed, Mark, on the table. You know, the sport is traditional. It works. There's nothing wrong with the product.
Yeah. No, and I think what that story also reminds us is that, you know, different cities want different things out of their sporting events. So we'll take a colleague there who's going to be new and then we'll come to you, yeah?
Just following on from your point there.
Just say who.
Oh, sorry. Yeah. David Norris from Beyond 90. What you prove there is that if a sport commits to a city over a long period of time, the benefits are there. So to answer the question, what sports can do to make themselves appealing is to stop moving around, you know, and to take your model of a single sport and then to take that to a multi-sport event, something like the Commonwealth Games, and go, right, we're going to go 4 years. So we're going to stay in Glasgow for 2014, 2018 and 2022 to really build a huge legacy. And that, I think, could be a really interesting way of approaching this. And I know it seems odd to have less cities bidding for stuff, but, you know, to go for a very long period could be a very different way of approaching sports, world gymnastics. If we're going to be the home of world gymnastics for the next 12 years, that could be a much more interesting way of taking world sport.
yeah, though, you know, if you're sitting in the Commonwealth and you're coming from Australia or South Africa or India, you know, you want your chance to host. And of course, these guys, you know, one of the things they've been doing is spreading their impact, and particularly in a market like China. So, you know, it's a balance between getting a stable environment, which they have with their world championships, but still being able to reach those new markets. And actually, if you look at the pattern, incidentally, of hosting on the major international championships, and you, if you, it's interesting, look at a map, and you will see the way in which sport has been globalizing incredibly quickly over the last 30 years, including the mega events. And I must admit, my own view is that that's probably, you know, a good thing, particularly if you're a global federation with a global responsibility. But it's a good point you make. It would reduce the number of bids to work on, but hey, that's okay. No? All right. Anything else on that topic? Yes, there, yes.
Not specifically on this topic, but...
Just bring your microphone slightly.
Sorry, Bernie from Brandoath. Not necessarily specific to this topic, but I can't help wondering what you think, or what the room thinks about, is there a value in bidding per se, or is it all about winning? Is there a strategy for bidding, even though you know your chances are very slim?
That's a good good question to ask. Who wants to try and answer it? Yeah.
It's an area of event bidding that's relatively under research, but I think increasingly will become more important. And it's mainly driven by the cost, or for some types of events, the cost of bidding. And back to yesterday's issue about engaging citizens, and in some respects needing to convince them to support bids. And often they see it only as a kind of one-sided equation. It's just the cost of the bid relative to all the other things we could do with that money. And I think cities could do more, and there is more research becoming available now about the benefits that can be derived from the bid process alone. And they are quite substantial. They're difficult to quantify, but they do exist. And I think in, you know, cities could do more to explain, if you like, or to persuade, if you want, citizens about supporting a bid, if they better understood the benefits, or if the benefits of the bid process were more clearly articulated by the city. So, does that answer your question, Bernie? Yeah,
you can use your own microphone. Microphone guy.
Yeah, Terrence, aka Microphone Guy, with Host City. Yeah, it's that idea of the legacy of lost bids, and bidding by nature, you're only going to have one winner and five or six losers that have spent millions, tens of millions of dollars on a bid. So I think part of it is going into it thinking that there's two steps to the bid process. One is, why do you bid, and what legacies can you get from that? And the second question is, well, if you win the bid, what happens? And there's been certain cities that have actually done quite a good job at that idea of a legacy of a lost bid, Toronto being one of them, where there's been some great economic outcomes. It redeveloped the waterfront. There were 60 years of discussion, and it finally brought three levels of government together, and they built the waterfront off of the 2008 bid. There was lots of advancements bid in terms of events and grassroots sports for girls and women that have continued on for the past 25 years. So there are examples where the city has used the bid as a process alone.
Yeah. It's a good example. I think, you know, the other way to think about the question is, actually mounting a bid for event X when actually your real target is event Y. And this does happen. And this is where clever strategies come into play, because you may be making a bid for a senior world championships, but actually what you have in mind is the junior version of that world championships. You get yourself on the map, you get to meet the decision makers, you can profile your city, and actually, you know, people like good losers, so they think, you know what, we'll give them the junior championships instead. So there's a bit of that goes on. A living example most recently was Cardiff bidding to be one of the host cities for Euro 2020, and they wanted that, but actually their real ambition was to host the UEFA Champions League at the Millennium Stadium. They didn't get Euro 2020, but they got the Champions League. Glasgow recently... was bidding for Scotland, with Glasgow as the centre, was bidding for the World Team Championships in badminton, didn't get it, but got the World Individual Badminton Championships. So, you know, sometimes you have to be again, that's part of understanding the world, understanding the way these decision makers think about being quite sophisticated and what might be your own secret bid. Anybody got any examples of that? Yeah, good. One here and then one here, yeah.
Thanks. Yav Abbas from Manchester City Council. I think the bids for Olympic Games from Manchester for 96, failed bids, and 2000, definitely made the pathway smooth for the unopposed bid in 2002 for Commonwealth Games. I think we're in quite an interesting position now because 13 years after the event, we have great venues, many of which are beginning to age at the same time, but on the plus side are all full. So a big challenge for us is actually finding time to host sports events that take over a week in venues that are full all the time. So the displacement of our stakeholders and users and event programs is a challenge. But also it's kind of looking as to what the next big thing to put sport on the map for our politicians, which will then maybe get the investment to make improvements or enhancement to those facilities, which will move them to the next stage. Whether that's an event or not, I'm not sure.
Yeah, there's another thing to say about the Manchester Commonwealth Games as well. If we hadn't had a successful Manchester Commonwealth Games, we wouldn't have had a successful London 2012 bid. In the same way, if in Brazil they hadn't hosted a successful Pan American Games in 2007, they wouldn't have won Rio 2016. So, you know, building platforms, I'm sure you're very glad to have made the sacrifice for London. But you know, the way in which you think about national strategies and why London came to the table, London partly came to the table because of the success of Manchester Commonwealth Games. So the colleague here, yes?
Hi, my name is Desi. I'm from UCFB Wembley. I keep reading the point, what sports can do to make themselves appealing to cities. And I just want to make a point slightly different from what has been discussed so far. So we're talking about sport events. And I just think, what is it that the sport and the sport, let's say, international governing body or international federation can do to make themselves appealing to cities? And I'm going to give you an example. My background is in gymnastics, and we heard gymnastics being discussed quite a few times over the course of the conference, but I believe I'm not going to be wrong if I assume that by gymnastics, most of you are imagining artistic gymnastics, right? And there's nothing wrong in that. My background is in rhythmic gymnastics. Rhythmic gymnastics is, well, of course, people can argue with that, but it has been said that it's one of the most difficult sports that you would not necessarily believe how difficult the sport is. And it is one of the most attractive sports at the Olympics. At London 2012, I was actually working at ticketing at the time, and I found out that the tickets for rhythmic gymnastics were the first one that sold out. The first one for rhythmic gymnastics. Wembley Arena in 2012, over the course of the 4 days in which the competition for rhythmic gymnastics was packed. It was honestly packed with numbers in the audience. And it was a spectacular event, absolutely amazing event. But let me bring you a bit earlier on. So in the course of time, rhythmic gymnastics had evolved so much that it reached a point where it got too complicated for the audience to understand the sport. And it really was. It was complicated for me as an athlete. Later on, it was complicated for me as a coach and judge to put a 90-second routine together. There was just so much that a poor little gymnast, because gymnastics is quite a young sport, and gymnasts are children most of the time or teenagers. The amount of pressure that you put your gymnast in 90 seconds is unbelievable. So what did the sport did to become more appealing to the audience, and therefore hopefully when it comes to sport events in gymnastics, to the city as well, they changed the code of points. They simplified the code of points. The code of points from over 60 pages was reduced down to 40, 45 pages. They simplified it massively to the point where gymnastics was still competitive, still complicated, still difficult, but the emphasis went back to elegance. The emphasis went back to performing the most appealing and the most beautiful aspects of the sport without the extremes that used to scare many parents to see what their children are put under. So in Rio 2016 and hopefully afterwards in Tokyo and etc., we're going to witness a completely new form of rhythmic gymnastics, completely different and, in my personal opinion, what the sport should be. Recently at the European Championships, I think, in Germany, there was a great audience and it was a great tournament. The European Games in Baku were also absolutely spectacular in the rhythmic gymnastics events. I couldn't take my eyes off the smooth running of the competition in rhythmic gymnastics, the performance of the gymnasts, and the whole organization behind, absolutely amazing. And yet, I think that the challenge that sports actually have is not only how can they make themselves appealing to cities, but how can they make themselves appealing to cities where that sport is not that popular. Because look at the UK, and yes, I told you that the London 2012 Olympics were packed in rhythmic gymnastics, but how likely is the UK to ever see a European or World Championships in rhythmic gymnastics? Does any of you know that in London 2012, it was the first ever Olympic Games in modern Olympic history that Great Britain was represented by a full team in rhythmic gymnastics, individual and group. And their only target was to qualify for the Olympics, even though Great Britain was the host. They qualified and they made history. And I happen to be the coach of the captain of the group team. And I know how costly and how hard that was, and what an achievement it was, what a milestone it set for the sport, to the point that British gymnastics completely changed their strategy for rhythmic gymnastics for the upcoming Olympics. And they may not send a team to Rio, but they're already preparing their team for Tokyo 2020. And the current and last year's, it is the same girl, a national champion in rhythmic gymnastics, is in the squad and has been in the national squad for 2 years. So the sport has the roots to change rhythmic gymnastics, but how can it overcome the fact that it has to compete with, let's say, artistic gymnastics and other sports that just happen to be more popular and have more funding and emphasis, etc., and media coverage, etc., and all of that in countries like, in this case, the example that gave the UK.
Thank you. It sounds as though we should have a separate seminar over lunch, actually, on the future of rhythmic gymnastics. I think what I wanted to draw out from there was you know, the interesting point you make about the way in which the Federation has had to change its own rules and regulations to make the sport more interesting and attractive. And there are more and more international federations who are looking at that and the question of format and creating, for example, temporary venues to be in the city centre during the multi-sport events. But actually what federations are often not very good at, and maybe this is true, I don't know, of international gymnastics, is then communicating that to potential hosts, because what you're telling us is a story about the way the sports become simpler, more attractive, more friendly to the spectator, you know, potentially therefore more interesting event to stage. But I doubt if most people here knew that it happened. So, you know, if you're going to make changes, you've then got to also communicate them and get people interested in what you're trying to do with your sport. But anyway, thank you for that. It was very interesting. So moving on. Which I think for me is also fascinating, is what are the changing nature of geopolitics in the context of hosting, you know, which cities are now clearly investing in sport, They're looking to perhaps do quite a lot of international branding, profiling through sport. Perhaps the Baku European Games earlier this year was a very good example of that. So what can we detect here in terms of new players in the marketplace and what that means for traditional hosts? Any reflections on that? Miles, on a snooker front, do you want to comment a little bit on that? You need a microphone to do it. That's a danger of people I know in the audience and pick on them.
So geopolitics, obviously what we're finding is that, you know, China is obviously a massive investor in sports. President Xi Jinping obviously was announced about six to eight months ago that he wanted to create a business of sport, or wanted to increase the size of the business of sport by 200 times. And given that it was Xi Jinping who said it, it's probably going to happen. I think that, you know, there is a lot of investment that's going into sport in China, a lot more than some other places which are more traditional. But there's also some other really interesting areas. You know, Singapore has done a lot, and we've met with Singapore several times as to what they're looking at from a sports point of view. They're willing to invest. We also see the Middle East, obviously, kind of the Qatar, Dubai, UAE, who have obviously done a lot in kind of motor racing, but are also building some significant venues, not just for football, obviously, but for some of the other areas there. I don't know much about North America, even though I'm from there. but obviously, with Toronto having the Pan Am Games, was a fantastic success, and they're showing that they are very interested in kind of hosting bigger events. The Olympic, I think the Olympic question, whether they have gone from the Pan Am Games and do they go to the Olympics, I think that's kind of hit with some political issues. A lack of desire, I think, in order to kind of push that through with the realization about the money that it costs for major events. So, yeah, it is quite
interesting. When you, as a world governing body, look at those potential hosts, let's say, from new and developing markets, is it pure dollar signs that light up your buttons, or are there other aspects?
Well, you asked Jason before, you know, what do we do to the game? What do we do to the format? Well, in actual fact, you know, to the sport, to make it more popular, because we have seen some fantastic growth. In actual fact, we didn't change the game at all. Okay, we've reduced some of the frames that are played and things like that. But what we did do is we kind of introduced it to the world. We were very much a kind of a British focused, certain people on the board, pre Jason, pre Barry Hearn, were sitting there saying, "This is a British game and it's for British people, and we will keep it British." You know, to me, being a Canadian, I kind of said, well, hold on for a second. If you really want to grow this sport, if you want to commercialize it, you've got to take it out to the rest of the world. You've got to open up your membership of the WPBSA of the best players in the world, not just the best players in the United Kingdom with a smattering of an Australian and a Chinese kid on. You know, and that's very much so as to how we did that. So we've opened up the sport in that way. And at the same time, we've suddenly got really, really good interest. You know, we work with our broadcasters, Eurosport, CCTV5 in China, Now TV in Hong Kong, ONS, over in the Middle East. And we determine where, in actual fact, where we're getting good TV ratings, where we're getting some interesting stuff. For some reason, worldsnooker.com, now we're getting some really, really good traffic. Third most interesting visitors, or third most, kind of highest, is Finland. We don't have a Finnish player on the team. Oh, sorry, on the tour. We have absolutely nothing. But we've got three journalists in the national newspapers in Finland who love it. Absolutely love it. It hits, you know, it's in the paper every week. All of our events are in the paper every week. Eurosport is obviously broadcasting it. I think we're second now on Eurosport output in a sport, next to cycling, which is obviously Tour de France and the Euro. But it's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I think a sport like rugby, with Rugby Sevens going into the Rio Games and with the success of Rugby World Cup very recently here, there's an interesting debate about, I suppose, the nature of global development and the stresses and the strains it produces, and some traditional rugby folk not wanting Sevens to be a success and not wanting even in the game. So, where you try to think globally as a sport, and you're trying to maybe as a city connect to the global environment, there's often different dimensions to the debate. And if you close yourself to the debate, let's say as cricket has, then you may be strong in certain markets, but you're never going to grow globally. So it's a big challenge for sports to be able to keep traditional markets happy, but at the same time find ways of expanding. Any other comments on that? Or was anybody here with a view of, for example, the Baku European Games and what they felt that represented, talking about some new markets? No? John? Go on then, yeah. Take that and then we'll move on.
Look, European Games is a new concept, and good luck to them in terms of the route they go down. In terms of sort of the geopolitics of bidding, I just wonder, and I won't embarrass any of the cities that are sitting in the room, but I just wonder that increasingly international sports governing bodies are their governance models are being questioned, FIFA being the most obvious example, but there's a big IFFF issue this week, and other governing bodies are far from being perfect in their governance. And I just worry, and I wonder in terms of the ability for cities, particularly Western democratic cities, to bid for events, actually whether it's going to become increasingly difficult for cities to persuade their population to spend many, many, many hundreds of millions of pounds, dollars, euros, potentially on staging events that are ultimately governed by corrupt organisations. And so it actually, yes, of course there are different parts of the world that are more affluent than others, can therefore traditionally bid, and increasingly that's shifting around the world. But I think there's also a political element that it might be very difficult right now for a democratic country to go to FIFA and actually bid for one of their events when it is so imperfect at the moment. So that's perhaps another shift that's taking place right now. And I think it emphasises the need for some of these governing bodies to really sort themselves out, because the way that was done in the past will not be acceptable going forward.
Yeah, colleague there.
Just to go on that, I think there's sort of a push and pull dynamics going on with it's either that events go to countries who have a lot of money, because it puts these countries on the map. It's for their profile, whether or not we think that it's good, and that might touch on your point right there. And there's a push really from the federations, that federations really want to open up a market where they see demographics change, or where they see next audiences, or where they want to have developing their audiences apart from the existing ones. That's another sort of dynamic that gets into play, and within these two separate dynamics, you might want to sort out, which federations are more likely to go to the push or the pull for their respective reasons, where governance, of course, plays an important role in.
Yeah, Bernie Eccleston famously said recently, "Who needs democracy? I prefer to go places where there's none." Reflection of Bernie, but. I think the point John makes and you've echoed is a strong one, because if you look at the Winter Games bidding for 2022, all the major Western democratic cities that bid one by one fell out, either directly because of city local pressure or because of referendums. So clearly there was a credibility issue there. We're about to see it tested later this month with Hamburg and their bid for 2024, because they're holding a referendum at the moment. They've got a major scandal, ethical issue, not around Olympics, but around World Cup bidding from when they were hosted in 2006. Now, could that have an impact on their referendum? So I know it was debated a bit in one of the sessions yesterday. Personally, I'm from a school that says don't hold referendums if you can possibly avoid them. And if you do hold them, because your opinion poll rating is tested anyway, actually in the Olympic world, tested by the IOC, and the politicians won't stay on board if you don't have good public poll ratings. But, you know, politicians would never go to a vote unless they'd had a campaign. And the danger for it's not for me to comment on another city, but the danger for a city going for a referendum early in a bidding race, early in a campaign, they haven't had a chance to work campaign to convince, to communicate with people. And that's a double danger. It's not just, as it were, placing yourself in the hands of a referendum. It's doing so, not having mounted a campaign with the voters. And that's where you become really at risk. Yes. Is it on gymnastics or okay?
I can talk about other sports as well. I think I'll just give a brief example, which I think links with the push and pull dynamics. In 2013, there was a World Cup, Rugby Sevens World Cup event in Moscow, which when I ended up there, I thought that that's really odd to have a Rugby Sevens event hosted there. The event took place at the 1980 Olympic Park in Moscow. The weather was amazing. It was really hot, but pleasant hot Russian summer. And the tournament in terms of sport quality was amazing. New Zealand won, men and women. And the final match was played in the 1980 Olympic Stadium, just after a really big and scary storm with the lightning falling down right next to the stadium. So in terms of effect, you had the whole package. However, during the entire event, all stadiums in which there were matches were empty. There was no audience. There was no audience. The audience was me and my colleagues and the 50 students that we took from the UK to be volunteers for the event, and the organizing committee. That was the audience, and I'm not even exaggerating. So I found that really, really odd, and I thought that it's ruining such a great tournament, which otherwise could have been really appreciated. Thanks.
Yeah, that's part of the challenge of going to new locations which don't necessarily have particular sporting traditions or interest in the sport itself. So we're moving on to the final point, which is about tournament formats. We discussed that a little bit in the first session this morning. But how can they be important in terms of the efficiency of a tournament, the importance of competitiveness, in looking after the fans who have to travel? Any thoughts and comments on that? I think you want to comment, I know that.
Yeah, obviously. I'm Itai from Match Vision. We're a company that provides simple mathematical solutions for tournament formats. When we started this business, we thought about the three major issues caused by the usage of groups and direct elimination. One was inflexibility. When we want to increase number of participants, we have to double them all the time, from 4 to 8 to 16 to 32, and so on. FIFA wanted to have 36 teams in the World Cup in Germany. They declared it impossible, and it's not impossible. We found a solution for it, keeping the same number of days. The other thing is match fixing. We've seen this in London, when 8 female badminton players were disqualified from the competition because they were trying to lose on purpose. It happened also in basketball in the same competition, and it happens in every major competition. And also there's the bet-related, people from the ICSS could explain more about the bet-related match fixing that we see. And this is more related to the third point, which is low-value, low-competitive matches. When teams are eliminated or qualified for the next stage, then we see low value for the spectators, and we see the interest of fixers trying to buy spot fixing in the game. So we started this, creating mathematical solution for these problems, and in much later analysis, we realized that we can do this also to provide a way for multi-host event, multi-city hosting. Right now, in the FIFA World Cup, teams have to travel twice in the group stage. What this means is that when we do it in Brazil or in Russia, teams travel Well, they travel all over around the world without leaving Brazil or without leaving Russia. And we do this, and we have to build 12 stadiums in one location, a lot of implication on it. If we took mathematical methods, we can make a system that has stadiums all over Europe or all over Asia, and teams will travel less than they did in Brazil, less than they do in Russia. So we can take the next World Cup, instead of doing it still only in Russia, from Russia to the UK, with teams traveling less than they will in Russia. Okay, and this is also a way to solve the corruption around the host selection, because we won't be talking about which country should host, but how many stadiums in Russia, how many stadiums in Qatar, how many stadiums in Nepal. And this is the major thing that has been struck in FIFA lately.
Okay. Thanks very much. You'll be able to talk to a new FIFA president soon. They might be interested in your ideas. Any other comments or thoughts or reflections? We've covered the agenda. I think we've hit the brief together as a group. So I think we should all applaud ourselves. How about that? Thanks very much.